Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. For your free trial of the curated online cinema, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage.
A bastion of subtlety, Brian.
Look, man. Look.
I actually like that song. I don't care what anybody says. I like that song.
I do too.
I've been subtle before, and this movie is so not subtle that I was like, you know what? It would betray the spirit of this film to attempt to be coy about this. So we have Katy Perry, I Kissed a Girl. This is, of course, the Film Stage Show. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, with me today to talk about The Handmaiden, the newest movie from Park Chan-wook. We have, back from his brief hiatus, Michael Snydell.
Hello.
He has not been replaced.
No, he has not. We also have Bill Graham.
He has held on the fort.
Woo!
Yeah. And like I said,
I'm glad to be back, guys.
It's been far too long, is all I can say. We're actually recording this episode early, so we literally recorded the accountant podcast last night. So
if my mind goes to mush, then we just know that I wasn't ready for two back to back.
These are the worst movies to do back to back too for Bill and I, because like The Accountant, if you've listened to that episode, is like a string of nonsense towards the end. Beautiful, entertaining nonsense. Yeah. And then the movie we're talking about today, The Handmaiden, we were talking about this before we began recording. We literally can't extend our general conversation past like the first 30 minutes. Because past that point, the twists come fast and furious.
Mm-hmm.
Almost too fast, too furious. Oh my god. All right. So I was going to do a Tokyo Drift joke, but
nobody needs that in their life.
So we're going to talk about The Handmaiden from Park Chan-wook, who we spoke about briefly on the last roundtable, did we not?
I believe so. Yeah. Cuz I mean we touched on Korean filmmakers.
Well, I was going to say, we literally brought up Stoker by name.
Stoker, yeah.
So
yeah, I love that movie. Yeah, that, Stoker.
Because we don't really use these episodes to talk about anything else, we'll be diving right into that right after we talk about Mubi, the streaming online cinema. Mubi offers you 30 films at a time, specially curated by their expert curators. And you are able to download these to your phone so you can watch them on the go. Mubi every week sends me a list of things that are going to be coming out, and they're like, hey, you know, if you need anything to talk about, you can plug one of these. I will not need to use that for the entirety of October, because Mubi is currently doing Horrific October, where they are bringing out some just fantastic horror films from around the world and throughout the span of time, or I guess throughout the span of cinema's history, for you to enjoy on their service. What have they got coming out? Soon, you will be able to watch F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu.
Nice.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I'm actually excited about Calvary, which is a movie from Belgian director Fabrice Duvelts, I believe is how that's pronounced.
Okay.
I saw the trailer for this movie when it first was coming out in America in like 2004, 2005, when I was getting into my art house phase, which became an obsession, which became part of my life.
Okay, so that wasn't the other Calvary
not
movie.
Not the Gleason
with...
one, no.
Okay, John okay. Michael McDonough?
No, this is a horror film, and I would encourage people to seek out the trailer because it looked bananas, and I've wanted to watch it, And I'm so glad that it's coming to Mubi, because now I finally can. Because outside of like buying the DVD that's been out of print for like 10 years, this is the way to do it. So, if you would like your free trial of Mubi to coincide with Horrific October, sign up now, go to mubi.com/filmstage and get your free month of Mubi. Ladies and gentlemen, I know that previously I'd said that we were only going to be talking about The Handmaiden, but right after we hung up, so I'm technically coming to you from the future, we realized that Bill had seen Shin Godzilla and had some interesting as hell things to say about it. So before we get into The Handmaiden, we are going to give 5 minutes for Bill Graham to explain why Shin Godzilla is worth a look. So Bill Graham, we kick it to you.
Sure.
Don't sound so excited about it.
Yeah, no. I'll get it rolling. Give me a second. So this film is pretty crazy because it basically takes the idea that Godzilla is not only like this live event that is happening in front of us, but it's also has this global and kind of political basis to it that kind of takes place in reality. It's kind of a skewering of the necessity of bureaucracy kind of in our current world, where not only do we have to see what is happening, so Shin Godzilla kind of shows up out of the blue and starts wrecking the place over in Japan, and they have to come up with an idea. Okay, A, what is this thing? We have to go get some experts to kind of base it. And then B, what do we actually do about this? How do we fight this? Can we fight this? Because this isn't actually a foreign enemy. This isn't actually a foreign land attacking us. It is an actual creature. How do we mobilize our defense forces to actually go against this thing? And then C, what do we even tell the public? Do we kill it? Are we trying to capture it? Are we trying to just shoo it away? Like, and so it turns into this, I wouldn't say 90% is in rooms, but I would say probably 80% of this film takes place. And of course it's in Japanese, so it is in subtitles, and holy shit, the political machinations here move at such a quick pace. It felt like the film, especially when it's talking political nonsense, is put at like 1.5 times speed. It's like everything is just sped up, because even the quick cuts, you'll have two characters talking about what they're going to have to do, and then immediately, as soon as they're done talking, it'll cut to a different scene with more people talking, and then it'll cut to another scene with more people talking. It's like they literally were shaving like milliseconds off of this film to just kind of fit it into a tight window. I gotta say, when we first see, not to get into too much of the spoilers, but when we first see the Godzilla form, it looks crazy stupid. It looks like a puppet. It is a regression beyond the original Godzilla, I would say. It looks that bad. Slowly but surely, it kind of morphs and melds and molds into kind of a more typical looking Godzilla, and it doesn't look nearly as bad. But oh my gosh, when you first see this Godzilla, you're just like, what happened to the budget? I don't understand. This looks like a children's movie. Like, it looks that bad at first. But overall, I would say it's overly long, but pretty enjoyable in that it's just not what I was expecting very much at all. Yeah.
Does it take as long as Edward's Godzilla to see Godzilla?
Oh, no. Godzilla appears within the first... I mean, part of Godzilla appears in the first, like, 5 minutes, but then Godzilla himself in his original iteration appears in the first, I would say, 10 minutes. And like I said, you see him and you're just like, what the shit is that? That's not Godzilla.
Now, we all loved Edwards as Godzilla, right?
Yes. Okay. Very much so. Yeah.
I was just curious because, Michael, I felt like you were throwing some shade and I was very angry.
Oh, no. No. I was just curious whether it's a slow burn.
One thing that's also great is that this film has a... I'm trying to think what she is. She's basically like the... She's an aide. She's basically the liaison between the United States and Japan. And she is Japanese. And she speaks pretty bad. I won't say pretty bad, but very heavily accented English when she does. And she's supposed to be kind of the United States, like, arm while this is going on. And the picture they paint of her, her ultimate ambition is to be the United States president by 40 years old. You're just like, wow, they just, like, completely went for it with this character. She is something else. She's flirtatious and, like, really, really, like, tough, but, like, pleasant to be around. I don't know. She's something else.
I'm sort of looking forward to this movie because the last Japanese Godzilla movie I saw was Final Wars, and that was so bizarre that I can only imagine what this one is like. And I'm excited to hear that it's, oddly enough, like a giant political satire about the inertia of bureaucracy.
So, yeah. Who is the main character, Bill? Besides Godzilla.
It is a aide to the Prime Minister, I believe, is the main character. Yaguchi. I'm looking at the wow. Anyways, there's a lot going on in this film, but yeah, it does have one kind of main character that is kind of, I'm trying to remember his kind of storyline. His storyline is basically that he was given kind of political position as a good favor, and now he keeps kind of like stepping on toes because he's kind of a rebel, and he's kind of like, he says what's kind of on his mind and kind of the truth, even though a lot of the other people around him are just like, hey man, like, this is politics, you can't be doing that, you know. So yeah, he's kind of like a guy that's just kind of like a rebel and just says what everybody else is kind of like thinking and feeling, but a lot of people are like, whoa.
Yeah.
All so right. He's well, interesting character.
That is Shin Godzilla. It is out in limited release now. Previously, this was called, like, Godzilla Resurgence, right?
So it's also known as Godzilla Resurgence. Okay. I don't know the significance of Shin. I'm not sure what that necessarily means. They don't really give a reason why it's called Shin Godzilla. I think they ran out of names, perhaps. I'm not sure.
It's not like Collateral Beauty, where, like, the title line is in the trailer.
No, they never name him Shin Godzilla at any point. So, yeah.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for telling us about that. And now, back to our regularly scheduled Handmaiden. All right. That's that. Guys, are we mentally, emotionally, physically, and sexually prepared to talk about The Handmaiden?
Oh, yeah. Bring it on.
Let's do this.
I will say that this is a foreign film. It is in Korean and Japanese, so the trailer is going to be completely pointless, but we can't break from format, so bear with me. That is
a badass score.
I like that song. Where was that?
It's the international trailer wherein they just don't have any spoken words, apparently. It's just like, from Park Chan-wook, the visionary director of Old Boy, Stoker, comes a bold new vision. I should have been narrating along now that I think about it. That would be crazy.
Give me that score, though. That was pretty good. Yeah. I like that. I wish that was in the film.
The dragon tattoo vibes from that.
Yeah, it was.
All right. Well, trailer not as unnecessary as we thought, apparently. Yeah. Go look up the international trailer of The Handmaiden and Shazam it. Figure out what that song is. I will not be playing it again. So what we have here is essentially a
doozy is what it is.
Con man film. It's like a Mamet-esque con film. And I know I talk all the time about how I love Western and noir films because
you
of
do?
The inherent simplicity. Oh yeah, Bill, come on. I'm nuts about that stuff. So
I
say that something we don't get to talk about enough is my love of con films.
Oh, nothing Jesus.
Nothing gets me going, man, like a good con. You know, confidence game where shifting loyalties and patter and like people have got.
What about
like,
Brothers Bloom?
Oh my God, I was just about to bring up Brothers yes. Bloom. Brothers Bloom opens with one of the best con movies ever, and that takes up like 10 minutes, and then it becomes another one of the best con movies ever.
Yes.
Everything by David Mamet. Con movies. Maybe we'll talk about them on a roundtable once. But moving on, The Handmaiden, we're going to be super basic, very broad in describing the plot and then talking about it. If you're going to listen to the spoilers, not just that we're going to spoil things, but for it to really make any sense when we're talking about it, you're going to need to see this movie. And not to tip my hand too early, but I think that you should go see this movie. So
definitely.
Do it. Do it now.
Definitely.
A woman is hired to be a handmaiden to another woman. She is hired by a con man because that con man wants to marry this rich woman and then have her committed to an asylum after he's acquired her wealth.
Should we set up the time? It's 1930s Korea.
Yes. Was that's all you're going to set up?
That's all I'm going to set up.
I will say
that's the peak of my confidence at this point. I don't want to fuck it up.
There is some like there's a lot of culture in this movie. Like culture is super important, and I feel like I didn't look into it enough to understand the whole situation, and I didn't look it up before this podcast either. So I'm about to say some things.
can I throw some stuff in?
Yeah, if you got it.
So this was actually adapted from a 2002 historical crime novel set in Victoria era Britain. Now that's like straight from Wikipedia, but I didn't
Fingersmith,
realize.
Right?
Yeah, The Fingersmith. I didn't realize this was a book adaptation at all. I hadn't heard anything about that. I think sometimes it gets lost in the cracks when it goes from one language to another.
But like people aren't talking about it a lot.
Yeah, and I think part of that again is when it gets translated from one kind of language to another, or one kind of nation state to another, or something like that. Right? It's like, oh, this wasn't like a direct adaptation. This was more of like, okay, we took kind of the themes and the ideas, and we just kind of inserted it into 1930s Korea.
I've talked to a friend who's read the book, and he said it's hugely altered.
Okay. Yeah. So. There we go. Cool.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was hoping that Bill had like looked up the geopolitical situation, because it appears in the movie that the Japanese have like taken over or have always been in charge of Korea.
Yeah.
South Korea is an independent state now. And so there's a Japanese heiress living in Korea, and she has a uncle.
Yes.
And yes.
He is also Japanese. Yes?
I believe he's actually Korean.
He's Korean, correct? He married her mother's sister.
Yes.
Because
he
wants to be Japanese so bad.
Yes.
He says it has, I think he says something along the lines of it has a cruel beauty, or beauty is cruel by nature.
Yes.
So he has like this weird fetishism.
So, like, I don't want to make this movie sound too confusing up front. this is stuff that, like, you will pick up, you'll understand the interpersonal relationships as it goes on, but there is that undercurrent of politics there. Not
sure.
Only that, but they speak both languages, and at least mm-hmm. on the screeners we got, they're color-coded yeah. differently.
Yeah, so it is pretty interesting when they change languages and
yeah.
It is kind of a complicated setup, I'll admit.
Because it's a con movie, Bill.
Exactly, right?
And I say that with the biggest grin on my face.
but the cool thing is that even if you're a little confused and you're kind of like, ooh, I'm not quite keeping up, it's okay because the narrative is so, I don't want to say long-winded, but it's so... It's such a chess game that it tries to kind of set up that you are able yeah. to kind of relax and flow into the film, and you get a very good sense of who the players are and what they're supposed to be doing and things like that. So right. yes, it's kind of a complicated setup in the first like 5, 10, 15 minutes, but it settles into a pace where it's not like throwing things at you. It just becomes a character story.
They very skillfully yeah. reassert the plots and the pieces and the stakes yeah. repeatedly.
Yes.
So you're never like, you don't have to worry if you don't catch it at first. You will have time to catch up. But
it's fair to say too that it does not have the pacing of your average, you know, geopolitical threat. This is very much, if you've seen Park's films,
yes,
it is very much, you know, it's on a tear from very early in the film.
But I think unlike maybe The Accountant, this movie knows that if it's going to move at that pace, it needs to keep you up with it. So
sure.
you may miss things, but someone will go back usually. And again, not overtly, but very artfully slip in the information that may have snuck by you.
Yeah, slip so in, huh?
We are only going to talk about like the first 30 minutes. I'm going to ignore what Bill said. And then we're going to scoot on into the spoilers, because I cannot wait to talk about this. So let's start with our, I was about to say dearly departed, but what I should have said was dearly missed co-host Michael Snydell. Michael, what did you think of The Handmaiden?
Well, I'll say up front that like at first when I saw this, I did find it a little intimidating. I'll say up front, I really, really like this film. I have one major problem, which we'll get into later, but it's just an incredibly entertaining film that is just so, you know, cleverness is something that it's easy to start feeling like the director is patting themselves on the back. And it's to Handmaiden's credit that it's able to be so damn twisty and still feel like you're with them the whole way without feeling like they're, you know, short shrifting you or feeling like they're misleading you just because that's the only way this would be entertaining. I think even without its very tricky structure, this would work very well as a linear film, but this is like in the internal text, like this film lets you know within 5 or 10 minutes that, hey, you know what? Maybe don't trust everything you're hearing or seeing, because it has no qualms about the fact that anything can be replaced or unhinged. But again, it doesn't feel like it's just dropping a trap door on you.
All right. Bill Graham, agree, disagree?
Yeah, I think this film to me was just a pleasure to watch from the very beginning. It is long, and I know I've railed against kind of long movies in the past. I will get the runtime on this one correct. It is 2 hours. Thank you. Okay. I guess I won't, but
I'll get it right.
Yeah. So it is 2 hours, 25 minutes. It is a long film. I think, and we can get into it more, but I think the the last half is kind of unnecessary, but I do kind of, I was with the film and reveling in what it's doing in the last kind of quarter of the film. But overall, this is a very, very delightful experience. It definitely is erotic. It definitely touches on a lot of kind of taboo subjects, I think. And it's got a kind of really demented kind of heart to it, that the entire film, the way it kind of plays out and what ends up happening as these characters kind of evolve in the story, is really, really satisfying where they end up. So it's extremely well acted. And I think the writing is just really, really crisp. There's surprisingly not a lot of fat, I don't think. I think the film, again, it reiterates itself what the kind of character intentions are throughout, but it makes sense in what it's trying to do and how it's kind of setting up everything. So it's definitely an enjoyable experience, even despite its length. So
it still might not be for everyone. I mean, we should say
sure. I mean,
like,
look,
if you listen to this show, this is probably for you.
Like, yeah.
If you've stuck with us, you know, if you're the type of person who looks forward to this show coming out, I have a hard time imagining this film disappointing you, unless you're not like okay with sex.
I thought you were trying to say it was a sadistic experience.
Because it goes on way too long and everyone's screaming all the time. I guess, all right, so it's time for my thoughts. Get ready for a food metaphor. This movie is very much like one of those king-size Snicker bars.
Mm.
You know the ones that are like so big that it's technically just two bars in one wrapper?
Okay, I know what you're talking about now.
You open it up and you're like, man, a Snickers, this will be great. It's sweet.
I miss this.
It's delicious. You know, you're going through it. Sure. It's a little nuts, but you go through it and then you think you're done. And then suddenly you realize, oh my God, there's a whole other candy bar in here. And then you eat that one and it's just as good as the first one. Maybe you're a little bit fuller. Maybe you don't think you want it, but you're not upset you have it. Again, totally chock full of nuts. But then at the end, you're satisfied, because Snickers satisfies, The Handmaiden satisfies. This movie is bananas beyond all comprehension, but it's so like gorgeous and compelling. Yeah. Even the points where I was like, I'm not 100% positive I know what's happening. I'm still on board. And we talked a couple of weeks ago on a roundtable about needing to see a film twice to really get it and if that'll change your opinion. And I had said, if you like a film, like, you're gonna like it, you're gonna know you like it even if you don't fully understand it. And then seeing it again will help to open it up. And sure. I think this is that. I don't think anyone's gonna be swayed by their understanding of the plot, because I think towards the end the plot becomes such a broad strokes exercise of just sheer audacity that you're gonna be on board. You're gonna understand the ending to a point, and enough to know if it's the type of ending you want. And the visuals, the music, everything is just there on the screen for you to enjoy on a surface level. I think that this film uses POV shots very effectively, very artfully. It was one of the few films where, like, the POV shots didn't feel completely arbitrary to me. I feel like... What was that?
Go ahead. I was going to say, I mean, it's necessary to the plotting and the way that it's shot and things like that.
Sure.
Because, right. I mean, you're right. This is a con film, and we haven't even really kind of delved into kind of the con aspect. Obviously, yeah. Because it's difficult to talk around it, right? But
sure.
The con aspect of it definitely plays into the POV,
right?
Because you are given a limited perspective.
I'm not even talking about like the limited perspective. I'm talking about the times when like the camera is literally the eyes of a character.
Sure.
And it's just them watching someone walk that's like right next to them, or like someone sitting right next to them.
Well, Brian, what I think is like so interesting about the visuals is that in the same way that it follows the tone and like the plot trajectory, there's a constant like mediation between, you know, like a sensuality to the images and a remove. Mm-hmm. Even in that first act, which I know is all we're talking about right now, like there's times when there's just conversations that have no bearing on the plot, and they're still shot from, you know, behind windows or behind doors, and you can hear everything, but you're still constantly being reminded that, hey, you're still on the outside. Yeah.
I will say, and we can go into this more when we get into the spoiler section, which will probably happen soon. I have a little bit of an issue with the way the movie wraps up. Because even though it's a con movie, and we all know I love con movies now, when a person is being conned, and we're following just them, it makes sense that we're being held back from certain items. Mm-hmm. Certain things we won't know. Conversations they're not around for instance. So this is not something from the movie, but if a person is sitting in a bar and a beautiful stranger walks up to them and engages them in a conversation, and then they end up going to bed together, and then the next morning the person loses their kidney, then we should flash back to see the woman in a car watching that guy enter the bar, and then, like, you know, her saying to her partner, like, okay, I'm going to go talk him up. Like, I've read his file. I'm going to get his kidney. And then we see that, like, she drugged him and everything. Now, if there's another twist involving something else that the guy who was at the bar was around for, it's a little bit of a cheat for the movie to edit over that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this movie is a lot of sort of in on that. It doesn't quite play fair with perspective.
Exactly.
But I think that it pays
it's a little bit the point in that sense,
that's why I forgive it. But I will say that, like, there was a part of me at a certain point was like, well, that's not fair. Like, it's not fair that because when you're learning about that stuff, you're learning it from the perspective of a character who's also there. Uh-huh. And so it's just like if they couldn't obviously just keep adding characters who don't know shit. But if you're following a specific character and then you're following another character and they're both interacting at the same time, but in a different situation later on, it just feels weird that, like, it's a little more obvious. It's a little more constructed, and it makes the con seem less. I don't know the correct word, because the con is still extremely intricate and well put together, but the con and the way that we're seeing it becomes a little more artificial.
It does. It does. It hurts the ultimate con, I think. But I think what benefits here is that the ultimate storyline that we follow through is so satisfying that you kind of don't care that there's a con kind of surrounding the entire thing.
Right.
It becomes superfluous. Yeah. Right?
Because in this film, the real con is love.
Yeah.
And if you look at it in that way, what?
No, I was gonna say that I again, it's hard to speak about this so broadly, but if it was pushed forward more, you know, if we're talking about just the way that the position that the con has in the actual story, if it was pushed more forward, I think they were probably worried that it would overpower.
Yeah.
That
I think it's possible.
Balance.
Yeah. I get that.
Mm-hmm. And plus, you know, if you look at it, this is kind of how I forgave the film. If you look at it in terms of who is getting conned at what point and how does their con specifically targeted at them end up in the eyes of others, then that makes sense. But there's, like I said, it's not exactly a small nit to pick, especially in a con man movie. But it is the type of thing that you would never really see in, like, a Mamet film. You know, you're not going to elide over something that happened to your protagonists in order to sell a con later on. But it's fine. I loved this movie. I was watching this, and you know, my daughter's 3 months old now, so I've got to start being a little more conscious of what she's hearing. So things like The Wire and Deadwood might be leaving my babysitting rotation soon. So like when I'm in dad mode, you know, I'm holding her and I'm giving her a bottle, but I'm like, you know, I can watch The Wire while I'm watching my daughter. Not anymore. Like I just probably, you know, cause her first word's going to be something terrible, especially if I'm watching Deadwood as much as I have been. So in order to not be murdered by my wife for all the times that I'm dadding at home, I'm like, okay, I got to start watching better things. So like I've been watching New Girl. I've been watching Seinfeld. Cause even these, like at least she's not going to go to preschool and say cocksucker or something. Sure. So I figured this is a Korean film. No problem.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that there is some very explicit sex in here. And even though she doesn't know what's going on, and I don't even know if her eyes can focus as far away as my TV is, this is now the first time that I've covered my daughter's eyes during anything that we've watched together. So that was a real change for me. It's like, okay,
you're scarring your infant.
Yeah, the infant that kicked. I felt the first time I felt her kick was during Triple Nine, and then we ended up going to the hospital after seeing the Neon Demon because we thought the stress of that movie had sent my wife into early labor.
So this is why you like Triple Nine so much, huh?
Yeah. In fact, it was the scene in Triple Nine where Michael K. Williams plays a transsexual prostitute.
Oh, wonderful.
And now she's watching The Wire with me, so everything comes together.
Callbacks.
Yeah, good callbacks. But yeah, no, I had a blast with this movie. But again, it is... do not watch this movie with your parents.
Nope.
Nope. That's the one warning I'll give.
And maybe don't watch it... I mean, right now, nobody has that real ability. But if you do, if you're press and maybe you're listening to this or you're given the opportunity to watch the screener and you're like, oh, this will be fine. Put headphones on. Yeah. Put headphones in.
This was another where my girlfriend walked in and I was like, nope, not what you're thinking.
It's for work. It's for work. It's for work. I have a friend who just moved into a new house, and the guy who lives behind him has like a giant picture window that leads onto his porch, and he has like an 80-inch television. And I could see the ball game. I could see the pitches. I could see the score. And I'm just like, wow, that guy, if he watched The Handmaiden, he'd get some complaints. Anyway, now that we've gone over, because this is like I will say we're talking about this almost like it's pornography. It's not. Like the sex scenes in this are precisely what you'd want the sex scenes in a movie to be. They're not just raw titillation. Like there is honest character work going on there.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Character we'll work talk. That my 3-month-old should not be watching. So. Cora got her eyes covered. Are we ready to go into spoilers?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. No,
I would say, like, if you're wondering whether you can handle this, if you can handle Old Boy or other Park Chan-wook films, you can probably, this is probably for you.
This is actually a question I wanted to ask. Sex scenes in this one, more or less explicit / graphic / gratuitous than Blue is the Warmest Color?
Oh, absolutely less.
Okay.
Yeah. The sex scenes in Blue and the Warmest Color were, I mean, you know, delightful, but holy shit, they lasted 30 minutes. So,
I had a lot of problem with the depictions of sex in Blue is the Warmest Color, actually.
I didn't so much because I'm not a woman, so I don't have experience with lesbian sex, so I'm just like,
from like an aesthetic storytelling point.
Sure.
One of my good friends likes making a joke. She's like, lesbians do not scissor, guys. Stop thinking this is a thing.
Really?
I don't know.
She was outraged by it. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Because I asked a lesbian friend of mine once. I was like, this is something that seems like it was made up purely for men. And she's like, most don't like to, but if they know what they're doing, they love it. And I was like, all right, well, you know what? I'm not going to argue with you. That was just curious. So, anyway.
As a fan, what are we talking about? I should stop talking immediately.
What the fuck is happening?
I don't know. I was trying to end it, and y'all just kept going.
Michael Seidel is the one who brought up... No, you know what? We're moving on. Handmaid.
I mean, it's thematically... Come on. It's thematic.
I guess. So yeah, this is a great film. I don't know if it'll show up in my top 10. I honestly don't know. It's going to come down to how I feel about how the con ultimately plays out. But this is definitely one of the more fun, interesting films I've seen this year, which is something I think that you can expect from Park Chan-wook.
I want to see this in a theater. Let me put it that way.
I saw Antichrist in a theater. I think that's like the most I've ever needed to get out of a theater. I don't know if I need to see this in a theater. So let's move on to the spoilers. How, gentlemen, do we want to handle this? Do we want me to do one of my breathless, I'm going to try to run through everything just so we can get it out of the way and talk about it type of things?
No, I kind of do want to talk about some of the intricacies of it and kind of
sure.
Walk it through.
Okay.
Because I think...
I don't want us to get caught up jumping back and forth between them, though.
Sure, sure. So, we can walk it through, but like kind of give us
chronological.
Yeah, let's do it chronological.
So chronological for the narrative or for the?
Let's do it by the movie, and then we can kind of because it only really twists back in on itself just a couple of times. Because right?
so let's start off with the end of the first chapter.
Yes.
The we haven't said a character name this entire time, have we?
Yeah.
Lady, or actor or actress.
So Lady Hideko. Hideko?
Hideko.
This is why I haven't been Hideko. Saying character names.
She's the Japanese heiress.
Yes. Played by Min-hee Kim. These are all coming off of IMDb, by the way, so if I'm placing the first and last names in the wrong area, I apologize.
I'm trying to remember which
I think it's actually Kim Min-hee.
Okay. Yes, I believe so as well.
Now, the actress who plays Suki is listed as Kim Tae-ri. Is that Tae-ri Kim?
Yep. That one's actually right. Yeah, I'm looking at the same thing as you.
Awesome. So,
I might be totally wrong too, so that this will be fun.
So, Hideko the heiress and Suki, who also goes by, I can't remember what her other name is, so let's just stick with Suki. They have become lovers as they were talking about this.
Oh, Tomoko.
Now, the count is actually just like a farm boy. He's nothing. But Suki believes that she has convinced this heiress to marry this false count with the intention of throwing the heiress into the insane asylum. This obviously is weighing hard on her because she's fallen in love with this woman. When they get to the asylum, first twist, it turns out that the count and the heiress are having her committed under the assumed identity of the heiress. They have painted her up and dressed her to look like royalty. And they're like, oh, this poor woman, her mind has snapped and she thinks she's a Korean handmaiden. Boom.
Guys, there's something else that we should probably mention before this.
Okay.
First act isn't there a scene between Hideko and Suki?
A sex scene.
Yes.
Didn't I say that they become lovers?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you did. Never
keep
mind.
Up, Snidell.
Yeah, one day off and he's already losing it.
I'm rusty.
So yes, we see them become lovers. We've watched their relationship grow. That scene is actually very sweet and tender, and it's nice. It's how does a straight white male praise a lesbian sex scene in a movie without sounding like a pervert? I guess I'm just gonna fail at it. It's a great character moment, and I think it's to the director's credit and the actress's credit that it's sold not as pure titillation, but as an actual turning point emotionally for these characters.
And we do have to kind of mention kind of the background of it is basically the idea that Lady Hideko is pretty naive. She's had no sexual experience. She's basically a virgin, and she's just like completely innocent, because what Suki doesn't know is that Uncle Kuzuki, Cho Chin Wung, oh my goodness, wow, you know, whatever, her uncle is basically raised her to read these very graphic and sexual books in front of an audience so he can sell them as counterfeits to these kind of elite perverts.
Right. He collects, I know there's a word for it, but I can't think of what it is, these very erotic Japanese texts with paintings and woodcuts and everything. He has her read them to show off the wares. They are all counterfeit, the ones that he sells. And he keeps the real ones for himself, because he's a collector. Now, of course, Suki doesn't know this.
Yes, so she thinks
that she's just doing normal readings for her uncle.
It's fair to say that that first chapter has a lot, all these characters assuming things about each other. Yet, you know, as Bill was just saying, you know, you have Suki believing that Hideko is very innocent. You have, you also have Suki assuming that the Count
is totally on her side.
That the Count is on the level as much as someone can be on the level in a con.
Yeah. Well, he's her partner in the con.
So he
double crosses her.
Yeah.
As does the heiress.
But you're seeing, but even in that first act, you are seeing things where obviously they are cooperating.
Yes.
Where, the Count and Suki are cooperating together to make certain things seem like natural occurrences.
Right. So that all happens. And then he marries Lady Hideko. They go to the asylum. Suki is put in instead of her. And they're like, oh, this poor girl, she thinks she's a Korean handmaid. Oh my God. Twist. Flashback to the childhood of Lady Hideko. This girl, we find out, who we thought was so naive, was actually raised to read these pornographic texts to a group of leering men.
Along with her aunt as well.
Her aunt was the first.
Yeah, the original.
Now, the aunt's death has loomed over the first part of the movie. She has apparently hung herself from a tree. In this second section, we learn that she actually wanted to run away, and the uncle was not having that. And a cryptic phrase that he said to Lady Hideko in the first section, which is something like, remember the basement.
Yes.
Yeah.
Suddenly becomes slightly more clear, because we see that he takes Hideko down into the basement to show her something terrible. And this is like, he says, like, this is what happens when she tried to get away from me. We don't know.
And
what
then it cuts
yet.
Before we see it.
Yeah. Whatever it is, it's not great. So we find out that the Count actually spoke to her before he went to go enlist this other girl to be the handmaid. And he was like, I had this plan to seduce you, but I'm pretty sure you're not down for that. So how about we do this other thing where I get someone here as though I'm doing the other plan, when in truth, you're on my side. We make her think that you and I are actually like falling in love per the original, like, let's say plan alpha. Well, in fact, plan beta is in play, and we can ship her off to an asylum. You'll get your freedom from your creepy ass uncle, and I will get your money. And she's all sure.
The one other thing I would say in there that's pretty important to Lady Adeko's character is that the Count realizes that he will not be able to seduce her. There's a great line he has where he's actually at one of these auctions, and, you know, he's gained her creepy uncle's favor.
Because he's a forger.
And he tells the uncle about how, you know, he could get anyone to have sex with him.
He's a real nice man.
Yeah. And also a giant douche. But
he's a true red pill alpha male.
Absolutely. But it's important to note that the reason why he abandons his, because he realizes that no matter what he could do,
he's not able to charm Lady Hideko.
Right.
Which you know, goes along with some other themes that come into play as well.
Right. So she says, cool, get me like a real cute, naive handmaiden and let's do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he does. And we get to see that sex scene again. A little more explicit this time. By which I mean it runs like a full 4 minutes longer.
Mm-hmm.
Way beyond the point that we saw previously. And then it gets... This is where my issue starts to come up. Because we see that when Hideko actually falls for Suki, she kind of gives her an out. She's like, you know, would you ever lie to me? Like, would you ever betray me? And Suki says, no, never. I love you. This is great. She knows she's lying. So Lady Hideko goes into the garden to hang herself on the same tree that her aunt did.
I love that sequence,
that,
by the way.
That this, visual gag is so great.
Yes, we talked in the accountant about how there was a scene in this film that made me laugh out loud that you could never get away with in an American film. This is what it is. So Lady Hideko lets go of the tree branch, stops like inches later, and has this like pissed off look on her eyes because Suki has caught her and is like, oh my God, I'll tell you everything. This is the plan. Like, don't kill yourself. And Lady Hideko is basically like, I knew the plan. We were going to betray you, but I don't want to do that. I feel the same way about you. And Suki is so excited that she lets go of her to jump around and celebrate. She starts...
Or angry. It could be excited and angry.
I think she's a little angry. Again. Yeah. Yeah.
She lets her drop to hang. And then she's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And picks her up again.
Oh my now, God.
This is my problem, because the first time we see the asylum gambit go down, I now wish that I had thought up like cool con man names for all of these little twists. But so the asylum gambit, when we first see it go down, it seems like it's a shock to Suki, but now we know it's not. They're in on it now. And so she enlists all of her former pickpocket friends to help her out, so that when she goes to the asylum, she'll be able to get out.
It took me a while to realize that that's actually her aunt in one of the suits.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm being vague. Am I skipping ahead now?
No, you can go for it.
Yeah. Now, okay. So again, like what Suki does is then they get the aunt involved. Who originally, it's fair to say that Suki comes from a family of thieves and forgers and counterfeiters. Like her mom.
Style.
Sure. Her mom was a legendary thief who was actually hung. So there's a synthesis there as well in terms of Lady Hideko and Suki, in the sense of they both lost their parents because of, you know, the circumstances. Chances of their birthright and the roles they were forced
Lady
to play.
Lady Hideko's mother died in childbirth, and then her aunt hung herself. So her both of her mother and mother figure died. Now,
sure.
What happens next? So now we shift, knowing that Suki has a plan to get out of the asylum. We see what happens afterwards, which is that even though the Count told her that he wasn't going to try to seduce her, he has actually somehow fallen in love with her throughout the course of this con that was falsely on her, actually on Suki, but now not on Suki anymore, now firmly on him. But he doesn't know that, and he's all, we can run away to Russia and get married for real. And she's like, you know, it's kind of foolish to fall in love with me, because I'm not into that. But he doesn't care. He wants her. He wants to make this happen. So she takes the morphine that he gave her as a method of suicide as his, like, wedding dowry to her. Super sweet. Because she was afraid of what would happen if her uncle caught her. And she decides to drug his wine. This is actually a super good scene. This is, like, some real erotic Hitchcock stuff. Because she comes with two wine glasses and is like, you know what? I've thought about it. I will, you know, be yours. And she's like, let's drink to it. And he's like, I want to drink to this. I want to get down with you. And so after she drinks her own wine.
In a not totally consensual way.
It goes from like him just being kind of a dick to being like a full on almost rapist. So in order to get him to drink this wine that he's not drinking, she starts taking a sip and then kissing him to feed it to him. This is a random question. In life, has anyone ever done that to you?
Like kissed you with some liquid in their mouth to transfer it?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, okay. That's happened.
Michael?
It's messy.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm very interested to see where you're going here, Brian.
I was just curious because this to me strikes me as one of those things that you see in movies like all the time, but that never happens in real life. And then, and like when someone like splashes cold water on their face in like a bathroom.
Sure.
Like, you just get through this night, Jimmy. And this, I was wondering, like, is this something that happens to a lot of people? And apparently it does. because you two answered affirmatively, I don't have to give my own answer. So, it's a good way to shunt off responsibility. So, he even tries to, like, justify it. He's like, I've heard it's better if a man forces himself on a woman. And luckily, he passes out before there's a chance for that. Now, at the same time, a fire has started at the asylum, and Tsuki is able to escape. The Count
with a hairpin that she's literally given in the first scene of the movie.
Yes.
Yes.
It's pretty great how many little things come back like that. Because now we're going to get to my favorite one, because it's something that I called, and I was so happy that it actually turned out to be true. The man, the Count, is picked up by some of the uncle's henchmen.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in the car with them. He's all like, ooh, this isn't going to end well. So he has a cigarette case that he's had with him, and we've seen a few times. And he has hand-rolled cigarettes. Some of them are white, and there's always two blue ones.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like, the second time I saw that, I was like, oh, man. I lived with some really sketchy people at one point. I know there's something in those. a friend of mine stole a cigarette out of a guy's pack, and when the guy saw that a cigarette had been taken, he ran outside to find my friend, pulled the cigarette out of his mouth and checked the filtered tip, and he's like, oh, thank God. And my friend says, why, what's wrong? And the guy told my friend, I put X's on the ones that have acid in them. And my friend was freaking out. He's like, what? And he's like, no, it's cool, you didn't take one of the X's, it's fine. Okay, so the guy has three regular cigarettes and two blue ones, and so in the car he lights up the three white cigarettes all at once, just
it is in a small little kind of sedan, right?
Yeah.
Little carriage car thing sedan, and at first I was thinking, oh man, he really loves cigarettes, and so this is kind of his like this is his last meal kind of situation.
Yeah, I got
and
you.
Then I started to realize, wait, why wouldn't he just smoke one really quick and then smoke another one really quick and then smoke another? I was like, he's trying to get rid of three of these cigarettes, and then you start to put it together, and you're like, oh, he's got those two blue ones that he's never smoked, and you start to realize, like, okay, is this his like emergency out? And of course that's the way it kind of plays out,
because he gets taken to the basement.
Yes,
he goes to the goddamn basement, and it's great
where you have an old boy callback.
So he opens his eyes, like I think a hood is taken off of him or something. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that he sees is the world's largest goddamn octopus.
Yes, in the smallest tank possible.
In the smallest tank possible. I can't imagine that thing is comfortable in there. Now,
no.
One of the things that we saw in the Hideko chapter was that after the uncle had left, Hideko and Tsuki had kind of like ruined every single one of his extremely expensive old books.
Yeah.
And so that is one of my favorite scenes as well. It is the way it plays out is just really, really beautiful. I like books. Books are great. I worked in a library, but the way
your love of books, Bill.
The way they go through those books is just so satisfying because you realize how much. And because Hideko, for a while, this sequence probably lasts a good 10 minutes. And for the first 7 or 8, she's not really participating.
Nope.
And it's not until later on when Suki really just goes for it that Hideko also finally joins in. And there's just kind of this, it really kind of cements their feelings for each other.
Right.
Because Suki.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
It seems like
Suki. Yeah, Suki is the one that's kind of instigating and kind of is really the one that's lashing out against kind of a lot of the situations that she feels is bad, right? Because she didn't know that this was happening to kind of, you know, it's a short, you know, kind of love of your life kind of situation. But look, you know, whatever. Love happens.
Courtship. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is her way of striking back against the people who have been hurting her love.
Yes.
What I think is so interesting about that scene too, it took me a while to realize it, is that, you know, Suki and Hideko, they only know sex through like a male gaze. They only know it as, you know, a woman being possessed. And it's interesting that even if you look at those first two sex scenes before that, they are things that she's essentially reading about in those scenes where she's dictating. So it's like at that point it becomes like a reclamation of them realizing that they're not going to be controlled anymore. You know what these pervy men.
Yeah, and they don't have to live up to like the male idea that's been set out for them.
Which is I do have a problem with the sex scene. I don't know if you guys want me to wait.
Yeah,
because we haven't quite got to the end yet.
Let's get through the plot, which we're almost at the end of.
Sure.
Because he's in this torture dungeon, and the guy's like, "Here, let me show you my bookbinding tools." And like any like any tool, they are horrifying and could do terrible things to a body. Not only that, this guy has a collection of things in jars that would make Ed Gein jealous. And so the Count is like, "Oh, fuck, this is terrible." And he's like, "Can I have a cigarette?" And the guy's like, "Nope, I'm going to chop your damn fingers off." And so he chops off all the fingers on one of his hands, then puts a drill, basically, through his other hand. And the Count's like, "Okay, can I have a cigarette?" And the uncle's like, yeah, sure, you can have a cigarette.
And the entire time, what the uncle is trying to get is the whereabouts of Suki and Hideko, which of course the Count is like, I literally have nothing for you.
Right.
I don't know where they are.
Well, that's fine. I've got men like everywhere. No two women traveling together are going to get out without like being inspected by my guys.
Sure.
And
but the other kind of twist though is the uncle also is like, "Hey, you actually slept with Hideko, didn't you?"
Yeah, and he's like,
"Give me the deets." and so I think part of the Count's instigation here is, "Okay, I will give you some details if you give me one of those cigarettes." Yeah. And like, he's just like, "All right, well,
now
done.
That you've tortured the shit out of me, give me a cigarette. I'll tell you a story."
Yeah.
He smokes, and it's great because he looks around. And he's like, "You know, there's no windows in this little cellar." And I'm just like, "Yes, this is the best." So he smokes one, then he's like, "Give me the other one." And the uncle's like, "Okay, just here. Come on, keep talking about this thing. I want to hear about you nailing my niece." And
who he also wants to marry.
Yeah.
He did want to marry.
He did at one point. Not so much anymore. The cigarettes, it turns out, are laced with mercury. The uncle dies. So does the Count. But as the Count says, "At least I get to die with my penis intact." Which, as a man, you know, like, that's all you can hope for at the end of the day.
Like, I guess.
You know, you die a rich man, you die a poor man. It doesn't matter, as long as you die with your penis intact. And then we see that the two heroines Hideko and Suki are actually going on a boat. Hideko is dressed like a man. They slip free of their bonds, and then there's another sex scene on the boat where they use
Benoit balls.
I looked this up
because I read or wrote about it.
Okay, so yeah, I kept thinking of the Archer thing.
Yeah, Benoit
balls. So they use these, and there had been a story that Hideko had read earlier that was talking about the chiming sounds that it makes during intercourse. And so the final shot of the movie is this boat and the chimes of their love.
And also a tool that she was beaten with by her uncle.
Were those those?
Yes.
I thought those were just like brass balls.
Nope. No, they were the same ones.
They were the same ones. Okay, I did not realize that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not the same ones, but yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, they were the similar mechanism. Similar mechanism.
That's what I thought when I first looked at them. But then I was like, you know, maybe my mind is just in a weird place because of this movie. So
it'll put you there. It'll put you there.
So that's the plot. That's everything. It is nuts. Like I said, a lot of it is like if you're not down with the fact that Suki becomes aware of the plot early on and that you go through her entire narrative not seeing that, and then you have to go through a second person's narrative to see that even though she was a part of it, then that's going to be an issue for you. I think that is a narrative device that unless you were to have begun with the count. But then that wouldn't have even made sense because he conceived both of these plans. So I honestly don't know how they would have pulled that off otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with the first and the second parts. Really, for me, it's the third parts that just kind of have. I felt it was unnecessary. It was kind of, and yet, like I mentioned, the sadism of it, the kind of satisfaction you get from watching kind of the uncle get his own comeuppance and things like that, and even the count get his own comeuppance is kind of satisfying, even if it's like, well, I really just want to spend time with Hideko and Suki at this point. So
I think the movie is interesting in the fact that you do have, despite what an asshole he is, By the time he's like stuck in a chair near a terrifying octopus, which, you know, did that octopus die?
I don't know. Have to,
you know, they breathe water.
Oh, I didn't see whether the tentacles were still moving. I should have checked that out.
But, you know, there's a certain amount of torture that I think he deserves. But I think what that uncle had planned in the long run was maybe too much. And I was happy that he was able to get the uncle and then die himself. Still fine that he died.
Neither of you guys mentioned my favorite part of that scene, though.
Which is?
Well, as he's telling this story and, you know, the uncle is literally chomping at the bit and just being a, you know, all-around creep. But he wants to hear the story of the wedding night. And not only is he delaying, but you're seeing a flashback that shows that they never even consummated their relationship at all. And in fact, like it just shows even more that even as the count believed he was outsmarting, you know, everybody, Lady Hideko, Suki, and everything like that, Lady Hideko always had the power there, which I love so much in the sense of you get this wonderful scene where this is weird, I'm going to say wonderful and masturbation in the same sentence, but where she is meant to consummate it so that Suki hears it in the other room.
Right.
And so it's, you know, you're given the perception that it's a wedding that's going through. But
and
yeah,
that's
the first
time you see it, you feel bad for Hideko. Cause you're like, oh, this poor woman has been conned into this and is now like losing her virginity, biological virginity to this man, which is, you know, we're led to believe that even more the next morning when we see blood on the mattress.
Sure.
But in truth, as Michael was saying, she was actually just masturbating and then cut her hand.
Yep.
All right. So can I speak about my problem with the sex scenes? And
I want to
keep it.
I would love to just spend the rest of this podcast discussing the sex scenes.
Okay, well, I would like your reading too, because I can see another reading here. But
okay.
What I majorly got out of this film is what I was going into a little bit is I think this film is so interesting because it's about, you know, the way that these two women are, you know, one are in a man's world, but they've only been conversant in the idea of pleasure as a service, not something that they can enjoy. And so, you know, the whole film from, you know, them having this very pure relationship to, or sorry, from Suki and Lady Adeko having a pure relationship, from them, you know, putting one over on the uncle and the count, to literally ruining the books and things like that. I feel like it's a betrayal of the overall theme of the movie to show the sex scenes. I'm not sure whether it's all three that bother me. And I do like, for what it's worth, the progression you were talking about, the sense that the second time you see the sex scene, it's extended. And that you do get a sense that this is not, that this is something that was a very strong sense of desire. But I did feel a little bit like Park Chan-wook is defying his thematic thesis by showing these scenes when so much of the movie is about these women taking back men who are possessive of their bodies, of their lives, and of their futures. What do you guys make of that? Or do you think I'm misreading?
So I think personally, the first section, that sex scene works particularly well because you don't know what this film ultimately is going to become, right?
So it still
sells the aspect that Hideko ultimately betrays Suki. Because what you see is basically Suki theoretically seducing Hideko, and you can still see it from this kind of male gaze of the male still win in this story, right? The count still gets what he wants. And especially in that second sex scene with the count and Hideko, which you don't really see at all, you only hear from Suki's perspective, you can see kind of her own heartbreak in that situation where she's basically convinced Hideko to marry this guy and then has to listen to them consummate their marriage in the next door. So I think the first sequence, the first situation, the first half of this film works really well with that sex scene. I think the second time we see that sex scene, for me at least, what it's selling is that Hideko is also taking control. It also shows that Hideko is not as innocent as Suki was feeling, because all of a sudden what Suki says is, you know a little bit more than I was kind of thinking you did.
You're a
right?
natural, because doesn't she say?
Yeah, she says something like that. And
did we not get that in the first one though?
No, we didn't.
No, we don't get about like 3 minutes of it, and like Brian was saying, it extends another probably 3 or 4 more minutes.
Yeah,
and we really get to kind of see the unfolding of them, of Hideko no longer being just seduced, where Hideko turns the tables and starts to really kind of go after Suki in that moment as well.
She goes from, because like Bill was saying, in that first sex scene, in the first time we see that one sex scene,
yes,
to put it that way, we see up to the point, I think, that Suki completes oral sex on Hideko.
Is about to, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So that is for that narrative chapter, that is Suki and her obviously having sex, Suki kind of coming into her own and growing in her feelings for this woman and becoming more conflicted. And it sells the naivete of Hideko, because she keeps saying, like, oh, you know, what will the count want? I don't know. And then she keeps saying, like, oh, yeah, you know, do that, touch me like the count would. And then, again, as Bill said, in the second time we see it, once that point is crossed where it had cut the first time, suddenly we see that Hideko's like, I'm just going to go for this. I'm just going to, you know, I've read these books. I know what I'm doing. So she goes for it. And you really see the first one, you thought that Suki was like a wolf in sheep's clothing leading this lamb to the slaughter. And then the second time, now that we see the point at which Hideko lets her own libido take over and really, you know, as Suki said, she's a natural. You see that she, the lamb being led to slaughter, also is able to throw off her woolen cloak and be a wolf as well. And so that, at first, makes
I think we also get
Suki.
Desire really well in that second act, though, even without... I'm seeing your argument here. We haven't gotten to the third one yet, but no, I definitely see your argument, but I part of what makes that second act so interesting, for me at least, was, you know, seeing that desire come across in ways that weren't sexual. In just that longing that becomes more and more pronounced, you know, that was something more along the lines of something like, I don't want to jump to Carol, that seems way too easy, but for the sake of argument, just, you know, bringing in a sense of longing, there's still something that just feels oddly like it doesn't understand its own story. Like there's just a certain sliminess, and I'm not sure whether it was that these scenes just felt a little bit too artificial to me, which is, you know, part of the point when, you know, you have camera angles that are, you know, off of ornate mirrors and, you know, just like off to the side of windows and things like that. Like it's very ornate, you know, a very
angles
a grandness angles to it. Yeah. You know, sorry, I'm going on too much. But those two, I guess I can understand, but I really feel like that third one.
Yeah.
I think I like the Benoit Balls part, but yes,
that's it's I'm sorry, go ahead. You say that because that's I kind of felt the same way. I was expecting they're on the boat, they're in their stateroom, and then maybe like this is the weirdest podcast. Maybe like see them produce the balls and hold them up, and like since we know that Suki's a little more naive than we had been led to believe, and that Hideko's actually the one with all the experience, you know, have Suki say something like, what are those? And then Hideko's like, I'll show you. And then have like the exterior of the boat and you can have the ringing. And I thought that just having the ringing would be an interesting turn, because it would be like, okay, well, we know they're having sex in celebration of their victory, but it would also be a weird inversion of the kind of like a victorious bell ringing, you know?
Yeah,
I do think
and it would leave it up to kind of the imagination, and right. I think part of it is, look, it's tough as a male to say what is too much and things like that, because you know, if you listen to a lot of podcasts with anyone of the opposite gender, and they talk about things like Game of Thrones and even Westworld that's going on right now, where we see a dramatic lack of male nudity, right? The scales are completely tipped towards the female. And part of it is just the way that we sexualize the female anatomy, where if they don't have a shirt, all of a sudden they're naked. Whereas if a guy doesn't have a shirt, it's like, yeah, but I see that at the beach all the time. So it's not quite the same, right? So the other part of the female anatomy is often rarely shown in movies or TV. And the same goes for the male part of the anatomy. So basically it's topless consistently, sometimes without bottoms, but the males just, you know, there's nothing sexualized about them being topless. Right. And so when you have a film like this, I think the argument can be easily made that, okay, if you want to satisfy the male gaze, didn't that first sex scene just completely satisfy that? So why do we have to have yet another sex scene with them getting naked that doesn't actually further the plot in any meaningful sure. way that having it seen off screen could have done? Right? Like Brian's suggestion.
This is what the film is like about.
I don't know because this is a movie about two women in a relationship really fucking over the patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And what was that?
No, he said sure.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
So yeah, I mean that's what it's about. And so like it's hard for me because at the end it's not like in an action movie where like the guy gets to have sex with the girl as a reward. Like this is what these two have been working towards. They are now free with each other to do as they deem. And I don't.
But why couldn't we just see the door
about queer lifestyle? I would be interested to know what a woman who has a queer lifestyle thinks about this film. If she finds that to be something that she wants, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because like a big reason that men in movies used to get women is because that's what they knew their primarily white heterosexual audience wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So like,
sure.
Is that a thing of like, maybe that's what they assume that a woman who's interested in women would want. I don't know.
Well,
that on a purely narrative level, yeah, it's an excess. But I don't know if it's an exploitative excess or if it's an empowering excess considering the narrative and the themes at play. So I can't make a final determination.
And I think part of the issue that a lot of females take with films or themes of this particular narrative is, okay, the kind of ultimate male gaze fantasy is having two women get naked and then have sex with each other, right? Sure. And it's what's interesting here is we have Park Chan-wook. I don't know his particular sexual orientation, but I'm pretty sure he's not gay. So he is a straight male and he's making this film. And this is yet again one of those issues where a lot of females just feel like, okay, what's like, didn't you? And like I said, I mean, isn't the male gaze kind of already satisfied in that first sequence, which is not only done at first, but then extended. But we both kind of explained, and I think Michael, you agreed with us, it's extended to both benefit the narrative and then also further kind of the characters there. So it serves a purpose. Is it gratuitous? Maybe. It depends on how uncomfortable you are with that kind of situation. But again, I think that moment ultimately satisfies as much nudity as we really kind of need from these two women. It does feel like that boat sequence. And ultimately, like I mentioned,
the boat sequence, I agree. But again, I just don't know. I can't.
Yeah.
As a person who is a straight male, I can't say whether that gratuitousness is exploitative or empowering in some way. Because they're not doing it for a man in the narrative, and it's not a guarantee that this is a movie that's only going to be seen by men.
Sure,
like,
sure.
The sex in Game of Thrones is just fucking bizarrely geared towards men. Like, even the lesbian sex that's in there.
yeah. I'm going to go fuck the tits off of this girl.
Yeah.
Which one of the females says... Yeah. About another female, and you're just like, really?
There's also a super gratuitous scene in like the first season where it's like Littlefinger teaching two whores to like screw each other, and he's like giving weird exposition, and it's like, even if you're a lesbian, I don't think that scene's gonna do it for you. And as a man who, you know, we have our whole cliched like, oh yeah, watching two women do it, that's great. I remember cringing at that scene and just being like, ooh, this is for no one.
Yeah.
And well, in this movie, I didn't feel like it was for me. Like, I didn't feel like the
really?
Aesthetics of it okay. were saying, like, hey, heterosexual male, check this shit out. Because uh-huh. I feel like through performance and through choice of direction, that really was a tender, expressive, emotional scene that even though I thought it was a bridge too far for me, wasn't put in there specifically for the purpose of audience titillation.
Two women on a couch on their knee. Like, it's just, it's the way I think I would have liked it more. No, it's, I think it's weird because I, you know, when you have so much of the film also playing with this idea of, you know, things looking like an inert painting and then finding out that there's so many more layers to it. Mm-hmm. I think that the movie is doing a disservice to that by still adding that layer of artifice. I mean, it sounds weird to use the word raw, but I almost do wish there was something more spontaneous to the way those scenes were shot. And that last scene, I actually love the last shot of the film. I think it's perfect.
Yeah.
In the door or in the moon, the transition from the moon to the sliding door. I think that's perfect. Mm-hmm. But there's that boat scene. It makes me start wondering, wait, what were you quite doing here?
Yeah, because there's no way that two human beings would find themselves in that position.
Yeah,
it's purely for an aesthetic shot. But I don't feel comfortable saying that it's. I mean, obviously it's a little gratuitous, but I don't feel comfortable saying that it's 100% unnecessary because it does sure. feel like, again, I don't think that any of those sex scenes happened particularly for me. There, mm-hmm. it wasn't pornographic. There was a level of emotion and devotion and worshipfulness of the female form through the eyes of another female that felt true
sure.
in a way that, you know, fictional cinema can be true.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. You know, it's heightened. Obviously, it's heightened. I mean, a fucking woman hangs herself, is caught, and then is let to dangle for a second because of an emotional outburst. This movie trucks in gorgeous images and a crazy complex con game with a you know, healthy, heaping dollop of sex on top of it just for, I would say for fun, but there's like a real thematic reason for it. And so I can agree that it's one too many, but I can't say that it makes it repellent for me or that I don't think it was okay.
And I think for me,
that's fair.
For me, I was completely satisfied had this film ended with the end of the second act. For me, that was kind of the ultimate yes. I was satisfied by that narrative, and I, as soon as the third act started,
when
I was
would you
like,
"Say the third act starts, Bill, just so I know which."
Well, I mean, the third act is literally when it says Act Three or Part Three. And we catch up with the Count at his, like, having dinner.
It begins with the escape. That's what I have in my notes here.
It does? I thought yes. It was very clearly it starts with him back in a cafe, and he's talking with Hideko about how he wants to be so rich that he can order any wine he wants there without having to be concerned with how much it cost.
So you
wait. You are right. Never mind. You're right.
But so you wouldn't have wanted that moment.
I have more issues with that third part than I do any other part of this film. I feel like a lot of it is unnecessary, and even him being captured by the uncle, I feel it's satisfying, yes, but I feel like it's
a
drag on the narrative that could have been very tight and could have been very potent, and it drags it out to a place where I was just like, you don't have to sell. You don't have to sell me all of the mysteries. You don't have to show me the card tricks from beginning to end. I can be satisfied by you just showing me and not having to explain what was actually going on there. So no, it felt extraneous in that way. And it lasts about 20, 25 minutes, I think, the final part
it's
is.
It's at 154.
It's an indulgence for sure, but I think that the movie would maybe have a little less thematic impact if you didn't see these two men being punished for their attempted exploitation of these two women.
Sure. I think its length is what bothers me more than anything. And it's hard to justify having I'm trying to remember what they term it as. Is it part three or it's something
it
like
part
that.
Three.
It's part three. So they call it part three. And so I don't know if he could get away with calling it part three and having it run like 10 minutes, because
it'd
that would have been
like
very
epilogue.
Yeah, that would have been very satisfying if it was part three and it ran 10 minutes and it gave me everything that it kind of goes through, cut out the sex scene, cut out some of the extraneous moments, and that would just flow a lot better for me. And I think ultimately he didn't want it to play out in two parts. He wanted that kind of third act structure, and it kind of drags the film down for me. It's, now, given that, I was still entertained throughout, but I think that is the moment that the film doesn't necessarily benefit to my eyes by having that third act.
I think
I just realized a big part of that third act is they need to pay off the morphine. So that's what causes a decent amount of the running time in that last bit.
Oh, yeah.
You gotta
wait. Sorry. The morphine, or you're talking about the mercury?
No, the morphine.
No, I'm talking about the poison that we learn is poison. If we didn't pay that off, that would feel too small, even though it's, you know, it's representative of how the feelings that Lady Adeko actually has for Suki. But I'm just thinking about the way that is fit in. I think it would be awkward if they did not specifically pay that off. But Bill, I would agree with you that third act, or sorry, that part three does feel a little bit elongated. Although I still love things like when after he wakes up after he's being drugged and he's like, "You think you could pass me those pants?" He says that to the two guards.
See, my thing is there's
a bunch of little things.
The third act definitely strays further from what you assume the primary narrative is. But by that point, the movie had, to me at least, built up enough goodwill in my heart that I was okay with it. I was like, you know, you have sustained for like 2 hours without losing my attention once.
Absolutely.
I'm firmly invested in the emotional stakes here, as well as just the plot stakes. I was like, I'm gonna allow this. I have not felt the runtime, and so I will not begrudge you taking your time with this, especially since I knew what those blue cigarettes were, and I was like, I cannot wait to see how this plays out.
I just think my issue is, look, if you've seen Old Boy, right, you've seen kind of that ultimate kind of twist that he likes to pull out. Sure. I think even Stoker has some of that, and of course,
I think the twists in this play out a lot better and a lot more, I will say, organically, knowing that that is not the word I want, but that it sounds like it could be right, than Stoker or Old Boy.
Well, but I agree with that. But my point is that it feels like when I was watching the third act, I was waiting for another reveal, right? I was waiting for some other big revelation that it just ultimately is like, we already pretty much played everything that you were going to see. You know, everything that happens in kind of that third act is kind of expected for me. So,
I think that I don't have a problem with that. Like,
no.
Knowing what's coming and then like being able to like kind of luxuriate in it, I was cool with that. It's like the opposite of The Accountant, where the let's say that like if you take the last 25 minutes of this film, which is what we're talking about, and then the last 25 minutes of The Accountant, that was like a whirlwind. And it's going at the pace that I think you were saying you would have preferred from this, just to, like if you were to have cut this down by 15 minutes. And that pacing doesn't help. So they would have either had to cut things out of the narrative, or they would have had to up the pace. And I would prefer this little bit of like a languid letdown than either of those two options.
I can see what you're saying about the runtime, because it would feel rushed, and this entire film, nothing about it is rushed, right? It takes its time with its narrative, and it's very self-satisfied with its kind of runtime, and it's like, hey, I'm gonna be a long ass movie, but I'm enjoyable.
Dig it.
I think if we're speaking about, you know, the fact, I think one thing I like the uncle character, he does a lot of stuff, but I think there is a little bit of a rush in terms of when we're going through Lady Hideko's childhood. And obviously you don't want to spend too much time on that, but there is some relationships with a maid, for instance, that is very quick, and you know, she's kind of abusive and, you know, brings out foreshadows Lady Hideko's actual temperament with how she treats people. But some of that stuff is a little bit like, hey, we need to rationalize some of these behaviors. And I think some of it is a little bit stronger than others. Or excuse me, some of the parts in terms of, I think, for instance, her being taught to read the books and, you know, being forced from a very young age to recognize sex as something very academic and as you know, vocational almost. I think that's
something
stuff works
to
better.
Laugh at.
Yeah. Sure. I think that stuff works a little bit better than, again, like that maid, for instance, there's that scene where she's first at this manor and this woman's like, there's an ogre in the next room and he'll smash you. Those are good scenes, but they are also a little bit unusual within understanding, you know, even the way the library like becomes something that's locked. Like there's certain parts of this that feel just a little bit like, hey, we need to go back in to make this a little bit stronger. Like it feels like I don't want to say like reshoots or anything like that at all, but there are certain parts of structure that feel less, to take your word, Brian, organic.
Right. I think we've been out this for like an hour and 30 minutes. I don't know. Let me end on saying this. This is the type of movie where there is a fake like snake sculpture that is used as like the delineation line of the Temple of Knowledge where women may not tread. And at some point, these lesbian lovers, upon destroying the book, the library, smash the snake.
Well, I won't say that it's the delineation line of where women can't pass, because when Suki first comes across it, who is there but Lady Hideko learning, right?
Yeah, but she's not benefiting from that, you know?
But we don't really know that in that moment. We do know that she's miserable about these reading lessons.
I was about to say,
she
she's definitely
it.
Not happy about it.
But I think what it is it's the delineation line of the freedom of women to basically pass through, right? Mm-hmm. There's a snake kind of guarding this knowledge, and the only people that are free to go beyond that, you know, by themselves, is the male, right? Who I guess never really like fucking leaves that library. Like, he's just there all the time.
Certainly seems like it.
And chewing on like something black, I guess that's supposed to be like acid or
it's the ink. That's why he keeps doing it. That's why his tongue's black.
Well, but doesn't he swallow like a pill? He swallows a pill at one point.
He does. I think it's just because he's an old man.
Okay.
Okay. He has like mints, like these weird ass mints.
All right. So that's The Handmaiden. Again, a con movie. I love con movies. I think it cons the audience in its narrative structure, but I'm fine with it. And it's out in limited release now. Go check it the fuck out, because you won't really see another film like this.
No.
Until Park Chan-wook makes another film.
I mean, it's like a combination of like Trouble in Paradise and I don't even know. It's but that's the one that I kept thinking of. I keep thinking of like classic, because it's weird how it feels both, you know, like very Victorian but also very contemporary in the ways that it's, you know, about, you know, the demented layers below, you know, the gentility.
I think what this film proves to me more than anything is if you're not into foreign cinema, if you're not watching specifically the South Korean filmmakers right now and they're just kind of wave of just hits and fantastic output, it really give some of these other South Korean filmmakers a chance, because they are making some of the most unique, entertaining, fulfilling. Some of them are art house. Some of them are just straight up crazy batshit narratives.
Like The Wailing.
Jesus Christ, that movie. But
I was never happier than when I went to the Toronto International Film Festival 2 years ago. And they did their city-to-city program, and the city that we were featuring was Seoul. So nice. I got to see, like, four super great, very different South Korean films. Because, like, one of them was awesome, and I wish that I could see it again so badly. I think it was called Confession, and it was just, like,
oh yeah,
clockwork motherfucking magic. Like, I couldn't write that review well enough to do that movie justice.
It wasn't Confessions of Murder, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, because that was one I saw.
I think it was just Confessions, yeah.
Because I saw one called Confessions of Murder a couple of years ago that was equally fantastic.
I'm
sounds like we should just do a South Korea roundtable.
I would love to. Confession. I'm looking at my review right now on the film stage. It's by Lee Do-young. Mm-hmm. It's from 2014 from Opus Pictures. If you can find this, ladies and gentlemen at home, see it. You will not goddamn be disappointed. it's awesome. And then there was another one called like Scarlet Innocence that was based off a fairy tale. And it was bananas batshit fucking crazy. It was like a sexual fantasy that slowly morphs into a nightmare. And it was, I think that the main character, and it was played by some pop star from Korea who I'd never heard of, but like the auditorium I was in was filled with
just their fans,
screaming Korean women. And I was like, afterwards, I had been doing my live dispatches. And so I remember this. I stopped a pair of people and I was like, can you please explain to me who was that man and why was everyone going crazy for him? But yeah, I mean, South Korea, man, they're putting out some magic, and I say that it's great. I think I said like a couple weeks ago that Asian cinema was kind of my blind spot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Korea is the exception to that rule.
Yes, I would say so as well. Yeah. Especially and I got to say, like, even in critical circles, a lot of people really dig South Korean filmmakers.
Yeah.
You know, you bring up a South Korean filmmaker and people are like, oh, yeah, I've seen that dude's work, you know. And unfortunately, it is mostly males. But, you know, what can you do?
Now I'm Googling Confession to see if I can find a rip or something anywhere. Anyway, let's say goodbye for now, and we will be back.
That sounds like a movie. Come on, where are they at with that one?
I know. Okay, this is the problem with going to a film festival, is that like there's like four films.
Oh Jesus! Yeah.
From TIFF, that one year that I went, that I would literally, if I could click a button, and like 10 of my Twitter followers died, but I got those movies, I would do it. I would do it. Follow me on Twitter at Brian J.
So I can make your
the box.
Yeah,
this is the box. The box.
Yeah. So that's that. Okay, well, that's an awkward segue into telling people where to find us online. Bill Graham.
Certainly is.
Oh, wait, no. Before we do that, speaking of Mubi.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, let's give a final shout-out to Mubi for being our sponsor. You can go to mubi.com/filmstage and get a free month trial of Mubi, the curated streaming online cinema, where they are currently doing Horrific October. I'm going to pull it up and see what's something else that comes out, because I know we have those Ty West films in there. I know I spoke about Calvary, which I'm looking forward to. And they also have The Black Cat, which is by Lucio Fulci. Fulci? Mm-hmm. I have no idea how to say an Italian name either, apparently. And that movie looks
luxurious name.
Hell, it's a luxurious name. There's also one that's called Female Vampire. That's its name. So you will know what you are getting. Story about
synced.
Female
I like it.
Vampire. Yeah. What's it about? Female vampire.
Must be a female.
Yeah. So all right.
Well, let I mean, us... hey, look, I've seen two female vampire movies that I can think of, and both of them were excellent. So, you know, maybe this one's pretty good too.
Yeah, in fact, this is great. Here's part of the Mubi synopsis for Female Vampire. Female Vampire. The 1970s. Jesus Franco. Signposts of warning not just of horror ahead, but of also the truly plenteous nudity and sex.
Huh.
So if you need a double feature for The Handmaiden, in 2 days, Female Vampire will be on Mubi. Actually, I don't even know when we're releasing this episode, so it may already be out by the time you hear this. So go over to Mubi, check out what they have available now. You can also see things that they've put out previously. They do every once in a while repeat up. So check it out. Go to mubi.com/filmstage for your free month trial.
Okay. Guys, I'm looking at Jesus's IMDb page, and it's a gold mine.
Yeah, they have another one coming out by him. I think it's like The Demon or something. I'm excited.
It's not Vampire Killer Barbies.
No, damn it! Come on. Baby. So that is that. Let's tell the. I don't know what we'll be talking about next week. Just throwing that out there. No clue.
Moonlight, maybe.
Moonlight, if it's in DC, someone is like. I could probably look him up now. I have gotten numerous tweets entreating me and perhaps threatening me that we need to watch Moonlight. It's from Pitt, period, on Twitter. And he set a very ambitious production schedule for us. He said, Moonlight opens on Friday. I need an in-depth discussion pod by Saturday or Sunday the latest.
Yes.
Pitt.
Wow.
We usually get these things out on Monday, and even that by the skin of our teeth. So, and I told him, luckily, that, you know, it depends on when it opens in D.C. So we will see about getting Moonlight
he
out.
He said there. Nice things about us, so he's all right to me.
Yeah. I love Pitt. He's one of our constant people who talks to us whenever we do our roundtable questions. I'm just saying, like, you know, Saturday or Sunday, I got a baby. Bill's got a mustache. Mike, you've probably got some shit going on. I mean, we have lives we need to work around, but we will be doing everything in our power to get a Moonlight podcast out, so fear not. Anyway, this is like my fifth time trying to get us out of here. Bill Graham, where can we find you online between now and the next time?
You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me... writing about movies on The Film Stage and freshfiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter catching up on South Korean auteur Hong Sang-soo's work. You can also read things from me at various sites. This week I'm doing a review of the Rocky Horror reboot.
And I just interviewed Kelly Reichert at Movie Mezzanine. So check those out.
Awesome. You can find me tweeting about my hatred of fan theories of Westworld on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan.
Yes.
I promise not to push the button that will kill you if it gives me those movies. That was a joke. The old man gave me the box, but I have put it in a fire safe, and I promise not to use it. Also, you can find me on the Film Stage at thefilmstage.com. And that's all I feel like really saying today. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next time.